Well, of course, it all began in 1927 when a number of people founded the society, which is usually called the German Rocket Society. Its real name was Verein für Raumschifffahrt, which means Society for Space Travel. I must say that our sights were set high from the very outset. The society was founded in 1927, as I mentioned, but did not start experimenting until 1929. And just as the door to actual experimentation was opened, a new man appeared on the scene, namely Werner von Braun. You remember how we met?
Yes, Willie, I left school in the spring of 1930, and I had read everything by then that had been published in the space field, including your own books. So it was only natural for me to try to get in contact with you and with the other people who had been active in this field before in order to make myself useful. And I remember well how I visited you in your home in Berlin and asked me to accept me in the rocket team and get me in contact in particular with Professor Obert, who was all our mentor at that time.
Of course, Obert had written the important theoretical book. I believe it was a rainy afternoon. I know it was an afternoon. I think it was a rainy afternoon. My memory has this dimly in its background. What I do remember clearly is that I was not in at the moment you arrived, and you passed the time playing the piano, and I've told many audiences since that what you played was the first movement of the Moonlight Sonata.
So I must have been moonstruck even then.
You were moonstruck even then. Now, I'm not talking as a music critic. I don't know how well you played it, but that's what you played.
Yeah, I remember.
And then, from then on, of course,
I remember that my first activity in practical rocketry was to assist Obert and the other members of the German Society of Space Travel to put an exhibit into one of the big department stores in Berlin.
Yes.
There was a gyroscope in that exhibit and a mock-up of a rocket which Obert had proposed to build and several components.
A little launching rack?
Yes, a little launching rack. And
which looked very big then. It was probably all of 15 feet tall, yes. And compared to a gentry of today, you wouldn't see it, but it looked large then.
One of the pieces that impressed me most was a very rudimentary little rocket motor that Obert had used in his early experiments in Neubabelsberg by the UFA film company. You remember Obert services had been secured by UFA, helping him as an advisor on their motion picture, The Girl in the Moon, remember?
Yes.
Frau im Mond?
Frau im Mond. Fritz Lang did this. I know a little more about this. It was started late in 1928, in fall of 1928. Fritz Lang was then married to the novelist Thea von Harbou, who had written the book. And at first they had Max Valier in mind as a scientific advisor because he was doing most of the newspaper writing and his name was known. For some reason, Fritz Lang decided that Max Valier was not the man for him and he wanted somebody better. And so he wrote a long letter to Professor Obert, who then lived in Romania. And at the last moment, Fritz Lang changed his mind in one respect. He had the letter sent as a telegram. It was several pages long. And then Obert came to Berlin. And while the filming was going on, and Obert gave all this advice, we started talking, by we, I mean myself largely, to Lang whether the premiere of the movie could not be combined with an actual rocket shot.
Wasn't it so, Willie, that originally Fritz Lang offered Obert a very substantial remuneration for his services, and Obert said, well, I would rather see you finance some rocket tests that I would like to make with that money. And when Lang saw these big flames shooting through his studios, yeah, then he was so impressed that he said, now let's get crack and build a rocket, and can't we synchronize the firing of that rocket with our first
Yes,
the premiere show of the movie.
Well, Lang saying so made it official, you know.
Yes.
The Obert himself had taken about half of his salary and put it aside for experimental purposes.
I see.
And half of it he used up to live and to support his family. The other half he put aside. The whole thing then fizzled in some respect. Obert had put his money in that he had saved for the purpose. Fritz Lang had put a substantial sum in, 26,000 German marks or something like this, and the company was supposed to put the same amount in but didn't and did not reimburse Fritz Lang.
Oh,
who
I didn't
actually
know that.
Who actually financed the first liquid fuel rocket tests in Germany that way.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhat inadvertently, but he did. And the item you remember from the exhibit in the department store was the so-called Kegeldüse.
That's right.
The first European liquid fuel rocket motor.
Now, I was present when that Kegeldüse was fired up for the first time. It was in the summer of 1930 on the grounds of the Chemisch-Technische Reichsanstalt in Berlin, which
yes.
is a kind of
something
Bureau
like
of Standards.
Like our Bureau of Standards.
Proving grounds. They had offered Ober to work in the open area, in the explosive area. And I remember this Kegeldüse was mounted with a nozzle upside so the jet would shoot upwards into a bucket that was filled with water. And that water served for cooling the motor. And there was a little gasoline tank and a little oxygen tank. We worked with liquid oxygen even then.
I know. I was there.
And
I was only a spectator. You worked there, but I was there.
I worked as an apprentice mechanic. So
yes, yes. I was there too as a spectator.
Mm.
And now this time I know it was a rainy day.
Yes, yes.
We always had to run for shelter and then...
Well, I remember the very first test for that Kegeldüse that was successful was prepared something like this. We had an old oil-drenched rag that was mounted at the end of a long pole. And Klaus Riedel, you know?
Yes.
Had to open the valves. No, I had to open the valves, and Klaus Riedel had to put that burning petrol-soaked rug over the motor while I was opening the valves, and then Klaus had to jump back behind cover before the thing exploded or lit up. And after several tests, it started with a big bang, and then we had a run of about 90 seconds duration, where, if I remember correctly, 7 kilograms of thrust
what?
Produced. Several years earlier, namely in 1926, Robert Goddard had already free flight fired a liquid fuel rocket. We thought we were the first in the world.
Oh, yes, we were convinced we were, because Goddard had done this in March 26, but hadn't published it until 36.
Yes.
And in this 10-year interval, of course, every little success that we had, we proudly considered a first in history.
Yes.
Now then, after the experiment with Obert's Kegeldüse, didn't you then go to Switzerland to study for a while?
Wait a minute. Obert left us in the fall of 1930 after the... After this German Bureau of Standard had certified him
yes.
that the Kegeldüse had performed, had
yeah.
produced these 7 kilograms of thrust for 90 seconds. His leave from his school in Romania expired, and he decided that he had to go home. His resources were used up, but he had achieved what one could expect under the circumstances. And then in fall 1930, his main assistant at that time, Rudolf Nebel, said, let's continue this. I think rocketry is a great thing, and the old man is now going back to Romania, but we don't want this thing to die on the vine here.
Yes.
And Nebel went a little window shopping in the area, northern Berlin, for a suitable terrain where we could conduct rocket experiments. And high-pressure salesman that he was, he managed to talk the city administration of Reinickendorf out of about 300 acres of an old abandoned munitions dump or
yes.
whatever it was.
It had been a munitions dump during the First World War.
And all he paid for, if I remember, was 1 mark registration fee for the deal.
And then 1 mark per month, a quarter a month rent.
I see. Uh-huh. Well, that was, of course, outrageous.
It was outrageous. And the reason why he got this so cheap was that it had been an ammunition dump. You know, all the buildings were surrounded by high earth walls. And although the land belonged to the city, the buildings belonged to the army, who would not let anybody touch those earth walls.
I see.
So it was unsaleable and unrentable.
Anyway, in the fall of 30, we thereupon started scrounging around for equipment that was put in there.
Yes.
And in early 1931, the first rocket motors were fired up in this on these grounds. And I remember that you were present there several times.
Oh, yes, I was on quite often. As a matter of fact, I often was on when you were not, you know.
Yes. Well, you were actually with the you were vice president of the parent organization of the society, so speaking. We were just the field engineers.
Well, I was vice president, and for a long time there was no president, which made my position quite strange. This design there, this of course was no longer Obertskegeldüse, but was this more rounded motor that we used to call the goose egg and names like that. Was that your design?
No, this was mainly Klaus Riedel's design.
Well, mainly Klaus Riedel's.
The thing had a very funny history. The way we operated in those days was that Nebel would come home in the evening and say, "Look at here, I talked one company into giving us these sheets of aluminum. And this is the material we have, so now let's build a rocket motor." And so
do something with it.
You virtually designed the rocket motor around the material that Nebel managed to scrounge.
Yes.
And another problem then was that we had no aluminum welders in our group. And so what Nebel did was, that I remember in one of these fishing expeditions, he talked a director of the Siemens company out of a sizable amount of steel welding wire, for which we had, of course, no use whatsoever. But with that welding wire in his trunk, he drove to a welding institute and told them, "If you would weld our rocket motors for free with your good aluminum welders, then you can keep this welding wire." So we operated on an essentially cash-free basis and really got the job done.
Yes. Yes, and then there were the first rocket flights. As a matter of fact, some had parachute recovery.
That was a little later. I left for Zurich, Switzerland in summer 31 for about 6 months. And when I came back, the first rockets were about ready to fly with a parachute in the tail.
You saw, of course, flights with parachute recovery.
Oh, lots of them.
Yes.
Lots of them.
Yes.
I think a total of 85 of these rockets.
85 or 87, I think. 87. I remember, because one of my duties was to write the monthly bulletin. And for this reason, I remember these figures somewhat better than you do, because I had to write them down.
Of course, it would be kind of misleading if we say now with that little money we fired 87 liquid fuel rockets in the day, it costs $1 million to get one off the ground. Maybe we should add here that these rockets were rather rudimentary.
Yeah, well, they were no Redstones and no Jupiters.
I remember we used an old tire pump to inflate the, or to pressurize the fuel tank.
Yes.
And the LOX tank was merely pressurized by filling it only 30%. And then waiting long enough for evaporation to build up pressure that will provide the pressurization. When the pressure was just right, then we would open the valves, and then if everything went well, the rocket motor fired up and it would get out of the rack.
Yes, I remember in one specific type it took 3 minutes and 45 seconds for the oxygen tank to pressurize
Yeah. Well, Klaus Riedel had a girlfriend.
Yes.
And she used to sew the parachutes, remember?
Yes.
She had worked as a seamstress for a while or something. At any rate, she knew quite well how to make the little parachutes.
Yeah, well, she had been working in the garment industry, partly as a seamstress, partly as a model.
I see. Uh-huh. So she was very pretty.
And she knew how to put a parachute together.
Yes. And we stuck that parachute into an empty can.
Yes.
And it was expelled by means of a little piston and an explosive charge in the rear.
Yes, it was a cork piston. Yeah. A cork piston with a little black powder to expel it. Hmm. Yeah, and then one of these rockets, one of the bigger types, which needed both hands to lift up, the smaller types could be lifted by a strong man with one hand, then was demonstrated to the German army.
Yeah. I remember one case before we get to that,
yes,
incidentally, that Klaus Riedel caught one of these rockets as it parachuted back to the ground in mid-air while standing in the rear of the automobile. In other words, that thing was coming down very close to the launching site, and he, another fellow drove that car right into the pasture there with Klaus Riedel, trying to grab that rocket out of the air before it hit the ground, would get injured.
Yes.
And he really caught it there. It was fired the next day again.
I heard that story. I wasn't present when this was done, but I know this, yes, this was accomplished. So all the things that you now have in headlines were done by us then on a small scale.
Yes.
And sometimes successfully.
Yeah.
Now, then one of the bigger rockets, the ones that you needed both hands to lift, was demonstrated to the German army. On that occasion, I was not present.
Well, they drove up, they had witnesses, I think, several tests. They were always coming in civilian clothes and were just watching.
Well, these demonstrations at the testing field, of course, were used to make some money. Engineering societies and other interested people paid $1 each to watch a demonstration. And as we learned later on, there must have been German army personnel, not in uniform, of course, who paid $1 to look at all these things. Isn't that how it came about?
Yes. I remember that among the many visitors we had, there were three men in Mufti who came in and what looked like a military car with civilian license plates on, and they were greatly interested in what we were doing. And I remember that after a demonstration of one of our little water-cooled motors on the captive test stand, they invited us to give them a free-flight demonstration on the Army Proving Ground in Kummersdorf.
Yeah, that was one of the long, long ones where the two tanks were on the same axis, wasn't
yes.
it?
Yes. Yes, one after the other.
Yeah.
Of course, stark repulsor.
The one stick repulsor, yes. Yes.
Well, that demonstration took place in the June of 1932, and it wasn't quite successful. The missile took off all right from the launcher, but having no guidance and having a pretty stiff wind blowing, it veered into the wind, flew horizontal at an altitude of something like 500 to 800 feet and crashed into the woods about 2 miles from the launching site.
And what happened to the parachute?
I think the parachute was still in its casing when it hit the ground because the total flight time wasn't long enough.
Oh, I see. So that
the
timing mechanism never had a chance to go into action and throw it out.
Yes.
Well, and this then was the demonstration which was, in a way, the seed from which everything else...
Yes. What happened thereafter was that we, of course, considered the thing a success as far as the demonstration of a liquid fuel rocket in flight was concerned, but the Army wasn't so enthusiastic because we hadn't really delivered the goods and promised what we thought we could do, namely reach an altitude of several miles and then land the thing by parachute. Nevertheless, the Army was impressed, but they said they didn't like the loud publicity that surrounded our testing field there, and so they said they would support rocket development, the continuation of our liquid rocket development, only if we would accept their terms and move the whole operation behind the fence of an army post.
Yes.
Although the wisdom of accepting or not accepting this offer, I had a little argument with Mr. Nabel, as you will remember.
Yes, I know.
He felt that we were in a position to impose our conditions on them, and I thought that we were just completely broke, and if we wanted to continue anything, we had to accept it.
And Nabel should have realized that the one who has the money is the one who makes the conditions, not the one who is right.
That's the way it seems to be. At any rate, the consequence of the whole thing was that I myself accepted an offer by the Army to work in Kummersdorf on their proving ground on the development of rockets, whereas Nabel continued to work in on the Reinickendorf field for another 2 years until he was finally so broke that he had to give up.
Yes, until the whole thing collapsed.
Yes.
Essentially for lack of cash.
Yes. Well, now, what happened thereafter was, of course, pretty much under wraps, but it didn't start out as a high-priority program by a long shot. I started working for the German Army with one mechanic at my disposal, so it was a very humble beginning.
Yeah.
In 1935, 1934, we had finally reached the point where we could test fly two small liquid-fuel rockets with about 660 pounds of thrust each and 16 seconds burning time. And these two rockets both flew very successfully. They were launched shortly before Christmas 1934 on the island of Borkum in the North Sea.
Was that 34?
It was 34. That's right.
34?
Yes, 34.
This is the type that was called the A2.
The A2, that's right.
The A1 was a Kiwi. It never got off the ground, but wasn't supposed to.
Yes. We call these two birds Max and Moritz.
In America, the Katzenjammer kids.
Yes.
And they were the first successful flight, and this was in 34. And then...
Well, as a result of that, I got a little more money, because now it looked like we had made our point. And by 1937, my little experimental station in Kummersdorf had developed into a group of about 80 people. We had three captive test stands at our disposal. Our next ambitious program was the so-called A3. That was a completely gyroscopically controlled rocket with jet vanes. We test flew these first A3s in 1937, whereas the power plant was completely successful and the rocket behaved all right structurally too. The steering mechanism proved to be a complete failure.
Yes, and then that was the A3, which...
Yes.
Behaved as a rocket, but did not behave as a missile.
No, that's probably a pretty good way of putting it. Well, what happened at that time was that the German Air Force became interested in rocket propulsion, and they looked around and found that we were probably the most advanced group in liquid rocket propulsion, and so the incredible thing happened that the Air Force asked the Army whether they could develop a rocket power plant for airplanes. Now, in Germany of 1937, this is just as incredible as it would happen in this country today. But it did happen, and we developed this power plant, and it was a spectacular success. In 1937, an airplane was flown with this 1,000 kilogram or 2,200 pound thrust in the vicinity of Berlin. We also developed for the Air Force, as a result of this work, some JATO rocket assistant takeoff units for heavy bombing aircraft. But the most important aspect of this whole thing is that the Air Force got so hot about rocket development that they said we would like to put this on a larger basis.
Yeah.
And to my very great surprise, one day they said... why don't you move out of Kummersdorf? We give you 5 million marks to build a bigger facility somewhere else, because we know you are too crowded here. This was an entirely different ballpark.
That Air Force engine for this airplane was still made in Kummersdorf.
That's right.
It was still a Kummersdorf product. Yes. Now, Werner, you know I wasn't there anymore. I left in 1935, so to me this is all second-hand information, but I got it from first-class sources, like you, for example. So sometimes I have the feeling that I should remember this myself, but of course I can't. I didn't see it.
Yes, the Air Force's interest, actually, in our work in Kummersdorf broke in late 1935 already, and this development of the airplane power plant, the first airplane rocket power plant, was conducted in 36 in Kummersdorf.
So then all of a sudden they waved 5 million marks in the air and said...
Yes.
Find yourself a bit bigger place.
Yeah, now, when I heard that, I got quite alarmed myself, and I immediately went to my boss in the Army and told him that the Air Force wanted to put up 5 million marks. And I was greatly surprised when this man, General Becker, said, well, I'm not going to let the Air Force run away with this business. I'm going to... be the majority stockholder in this enterprise, and he offered me $6 million on top of the Air Force's $5 million.
So he got in with it was $6 million additional?
Yes, as a result, we got 11.
Well,
that is how Kummersdorf got, how Peenemünde got started.
Yes, I remember that you went around looking for a place first, and then you had something on the island of Rügen in mind, but this couldn't be had anymore.
Yes, that had been assigned to some other organization in the meantime, so we finally landed in Peenemünde, but I think it was a better choice, looking back.
Well, I had that feeling, too, you know, after hearing the story that you originally wanted Rügen, which I admit has a nicer landscape, you know, where these...
It was very lovely there.
Tall, white chalk cliffs looks very beautiful. But on flat Peenemünde, you were probably better off for Hockenburg.
I had more growth potential.
Yes.
Particularly when I came to building a big airfield and so forth, and all these things paid off quite handsomely later on.
Yeah. So this was, now we are in 1937 with our story.
And in the spring of 37, we moved into the new facilities of Peenemünde.
Now, the A3 had been
fired... The A3 just got into the test firing phase in the summer of 37. So we brought it over from Kummersdorf. It was essentially completed there, but by early summer 37, we started test firing it on the Greifswalder
Oil finishing touches came in Peenemünde, and then...
Yes, that's right.
Then the firing from the Greifswalder Oil... there's an interesting little sidelight here, which we might as well tell. Several years earlier, one of the first president of the Society for Space Travel had tried to fire a small rocket, all of 5.5 feet tall, from the Greifswalder Oil, which is an island. And permission had been sternly denied because there was a lighthouse on this island and this might be damaged. You can see that when the army comes and wants to fire something, lighthouses all of a sudden become fireproof and there's no problem anymore. But
yes,
go on.
But I think the failure of the guidance system in the A3 proved very clearly that the lighthouse was still endangered.
However, nothing happened to it.
No, nothing happened to it. But the A3 still was quite a setback for us in the guidance and control area.
Yeah.
Now... In the meantime, we had already a new design on paper, which was to be something big. The exact specifications hadn't been spelled out yet, but it was supposed to be something at least 10 times as large and heavy as the A3, and we had called that E4. The A4, a nomenclature, later on got stuck to what became the V2. So as a result of all this, and the improved A3 that finally emerged from the... original failures of the A3 got the name A5 because we felt the reputation of the name A3 was so down
that you might as well
bottom that we had to rechristen it somehow.
Call it something else to make it look better.
Yes. So we called it A5, and the A5 was essentially an improved A3 with the guidance system perfected on static test stands and on electronic simulators and so forth. And this A5 was test flown at first without a control system in 38 and with a complete guidance and control system in the spring of 39. And that proved to be a complete success.
Yes, and that the guidance system then was essentially the one that went into the A4?
That was later on used in the A4 with some modifications.
Yeah.
You see, the A5 had only a range of approximately 16 miles or could reach a vertical altitude of approximately 10 miles. So it wasn't exactly a long-range ballistic missile, but the guidance system still had all the main features that the A4 or V2 guidance system had later on.
Embodied all the principles which were then used.
Yes.
Now that was...
summer 39, the test program of the A5 wound up with a complete success. Now then, as you will remember, in... the September, on the 1st of September 39, Hitler invaded Poland and then the war broke out. And that put the whole endeavor at Peenemünde on a very different footing. The army told us in very clear terms that either we had to produce something of promise as a weapon in the very near future, or we might as well go out of business. And so we... took a look at our old design studies on what we had called the A4 and asked for exact weapon specifications. And it might interest you that the weapon specification for what became the V2 were simply developed as follows. We said we better stick to the aerodynamic configuration of the A5 in order to save new wind tunnel studies and so forth. And so what was the biggest... A5 configuration that could be shipped through a railroad tunnel.
Yes, I know that. Sometimes thing hinges on things like the curve of a railroad, what length you can transport, or what tunnels have to be gone through.
So the army asked us how far could such a thing fly and how much payload could it carry. And we said a configuration, an enlarged configuration of the A-5 could carry 1 metric ton of payload over 275 kilometers range, which is about 200 miles. And on this basis, the army endorsed the specification that how the V-2 got rolling.
Yes, and you had the first successful test shot on, was this 43, October?
No, 42. Throughout 1940 and 41, the components of the V-2 were developed and captive tests were carried out with and without controls. For example, we had the whole V-2 mounted in gimbal rings on a test stand and tested the controls with jet vanes and everything on the captive test stand. In June 1942, we made the first free flight test, which was a failure. The second was also a failure, or at least a part failure. It reached supersonic speed and then broke up. And the third one, on the 3rd of October 1942, finally was a full success and traveled over, I think, 120 miles or so. It still wasn't full range yet, because it had heavier tanks and a heavier structure, but otherwise it was a full success.
So this was late in 42.
October 42,
Yes, I know, October 3rd, 42. I remember this because later on when I read about this, I said he could have shot this one day earlier for my birthday. But then after all, the Russians were 2 days off with the first artificial satellite, still one day later. At that time, approximately, the V-1 must have come in as a competitor, didn't it?
Not yet.
Not yet.
The V-1 had a somewhat interesting story. The V-1 started out as a propulsion project only, originally. That was this resonant ramjet.
Yes, the pulse jet.
The pulse jet, as it was called. And very early in the game, the support of this power plant development was actually a joint effort between the Air Force and my own department in the German Ordnance Corps. So I actually furnished some money for that development.
I see.
And it was only in 1942 or 41 or thereabouts where a policy meeting took place between the German Air Force and the German Army about which what service should do what kind of development in the missile field.
Yes.
In the meantime, it had become evident that this pulse jet was a logical power plant for an air-breather-type winged missile. It was not so attractive for aircraft as had originally been thought.
Yeah.
And the agreement that was finally reached simply provided that the Air Force would handle winged vehicles that travel through the atmosphere, and the Army would develop ballistic missiles having no wings and flying ballistic trajectories.
Yeah.
And so the Air Force, that had a design on ballistic missiles too for a while, gave up their ballistic missile project, and we gave up the pulse jet development and turned that over to the Air Force. Well, after the power plant was in workable shape for the V-1, the Air Force looked for an airframe contractor and brought the Fieseler Company in. And they built the airframe, and that's how the V-1 was born.
Yes, what I am aiming at here is very simply the fact that at one time then, after both existed, the question came up which one should now be used or which one should be produced.
Yes, there was an evaluation firing at Peenemünde. The V-1s were also test-fired over our same range at Peenemünde because we had all the instrumentation in there, and the V-1, having been a contractor's development, didn't have any separate range facilities, so they were brought to Peenemünde and fired from the northern tip of the island over the same range. And I remember very well that there was an evaluation committee there, and there were V-1s in the air and V-2s in the air, and the committee simply didn't know what to do at the end.
After they had been sufficiently deafened by rocket motors and pulse jets,
yes,
they decided that both should be produced.
They finally decided to continue with both, because it wasn't quite clear yet whether there would be any unforeseen snags by putting these missiles into production. We also were unable, that goes for both of them, to demonstrate the target accuracy of the two systems, and so There was probably no other choice but just to continue both of them in order to make sure that at least one of them would work.
Keep going and hope that both will, but be reasonably sure that one might.
Yes, that was about it.
And, well, then, of course, the V2 group ran into unforeseen problems with break-up before striking the target.
Yes, what happened was that up to the first successful flight of the V2, we really never had any high-level support for the V2 program because the thought was widespread, and Hitler himself felt that way about it, that this would be impossible to build a thing like the V2, and so we really didn't get full support. Now, after we demonstrated that the thing did work, the official position from upstairs changed 180 degrees, and all of a sudden we were directed to go into mass production, for which we were not ready either.
Yeah.
Because there were many, many problems still to be solved, but this created an entirely new set of difficulties. Mm. And the V2 then was put into mass production, immature as it was, and when we finally made evaluation tests with the field troops who were to fire it and employ it operationally, we found out to our great disappointment that about 70% of these V2s disintegrated before they hit the ground. We hadn't discovered that Peenemünde because we had always impacted on water.
I was just going to say, they may have done this earlier too, but you always were shooting out roughly parallel to the coastline, and
yes,
the impact was in water and nobody around to watch it.
We saw a green spot there and were always delighted when it was close to the target. But there was no evidence available about any premature breakups.
Yeah.
And only when the operational testing, which was combined with field training of the operational firing units, was conducted in eastern Poland, and they put some evaluation groups there into the Pripyat swamps.
Yes,
and in eastern Poland, they discovered that many of these missiles broke up prematurely. It was that I got a telegram one fine day that this observation had been made, that 70% broke up prematurely, and what we planned to do about it, because the production line was going full blast already. And at that point, we simply resolved, let's go in there into the target area and let's get let ourselves get shot at so that we could observe these things on the way down to see what happened and evaluate the debris.
Yeah.
And I lived there for about 2 weeks, and we got shot at a rate of about 10 a day, always live warhead heads for that matter. So I can really say I know the V2 not only from the delivering end, but quite intimately also from the receiving end.
You know it from both ends. Which was your closest miss?
300 feet.
300 feet.
It really was pretty close.
Close enough for anybody.
We had a joke in those days that the purpose of the exercise for these missiles was to make the target more dangerous than the launching site. Now, many mishaps, of course, happened in the launching site also, and I think the argument was never quite settled as to whether the V2 ever got to the point where the target was really more dangerous than the launching site.
Well, no, you couldn't expect this with the first one. Now, all this then ended in, as far as you are concerned, when were the first operational shots?
September 1954.
44. September 1944.
Yes.
And then you left Peenemünde when?
In January 1945, the war situation had developed to a point where the Russian armies had already crossed the Vistula River and were in the eastern part of Pomerania, and at night we could already hear the guns.
Yeah.
About 100 miles away or so. Yeah. And at that point, it was pretty evident that if we wanted to get out there before the Russian armies moved in, we had to move fast. We were under very conflicting orders at that time from all kinds of agencies in Germany as to what to do.
Mm.
For example, the local authorities said, you stay here and defend the Pomeranian soil. They didn't tell us with what, because we had no arms. The munitions department in Berlin told us to move out. Other people wanted us to stay put and continue development because the Russians would be reversed very shortly. So we really could take our pick.
You could pick the take the order that happened to fit in with your personal preference.
Well, what I actually did was I assembled my department heads and simply put the question to a vote. And we voted unanimously to move out before it was too late and try to move towards the west in the direction of where the American army was moving in. Now, this was, of course, not quite easily accomplished because there was this rapidly deteriorating situation on the inner front, and all the roads were clogged with refugees and with supply vehicles for the fighting army units in the vicinity and so forth. And so we virtually bluffed our way through with flashing high priority move orders under the noses of the guards and so forth. But we finally managed to move about 5,000 people and 12,000 tons of equipment out of Peenemünde. The heavy equipment mostly being evacuated over the waterway, I mean the ships, to Lübeck. Now, about 2,000 tons of that equipment finally reached White Sands and was the hard core of our early V2 test program.
Oh, that equipment, much of this still got to White Sands.
Yes, yes.
But you personally went to Bavaria.
Yes.
And
this, we're finally split up again. When we arrived in central Germany, and part of us were sent down under orders to Bavaria because they didn't want us to be so close to the western front line now. But in the meantime, the war ended, and finally we were captured by the American army practically 2 days after the hostilities had ended. We virtually surrendered. We came down from the hills and said, "Here we are. The war is over."